Dune by Frank Herbert, continued. So much easier to drift back down into sleep. But there had been a dream in this day's sleep, and she shivered at memory of it. She had held dreaming hands beneath Sandflow where a name had been written, Duke Leto Atreides. The name had blurred with the sand, and she had moved to restore it, but the first letter filled before the last was begun. The sand would not stop. Her dream became wailing, louder and louder. That ridiculous wailing, part of her mind had realized the sound was her own voice as a tiny child, little more than a baby. A woman not quite visible to memory was going away. My unknown mother, Jessica thought. The Bene Gesserit who bore me and gave me to the sisters, because that's what she was commanded to do. Was she glad to rid herself of a Harkonnen child?
The place to hit them is in the spice, Paul said.
How can he think of attack at a time like this? She asked herself. An entire planet full of spice, she said. How can you hit them there? She heard him stirring, the sound of their pack being dragged across the tent floor.
It was sea and air power on Caladan, he said. Here it's desert power. The Fremen are the key.
His voice came from the vicinity of the tent sphincter. Her Bene Gesserit training sensed in his tone an unresolved bitterness toward her.
All his life he has been trained to hate Harkonnens, she thought. Now he finds he is Harkonnen, because of me. How little he knows me. I was my Duke's only woman. I accepted his life and his values, even to defying my Bene Gesserit orders.
The tent's glow tab came alight under Paul's hand, filled the domed area with green radiance. Paul crouched at the sphincter, his still-suit hood adjusted for the open desert, forehead capped, mouth filter in place, nose plugs adjusted. Only his dark eyes were visible, a narrow band of face that turned once toward her and away.
"Secure yourself for the open," he said, and his voice was blurred behind the filter.
Jessica pulled the filter across her mouth, began adjusting her hood as she watched Paul break the tent seal. Sand rasped as he opened the sphincter and a buried fizzle of grains ran into the tent before he could immobilize it with a static compaction tool. A hole grew in the sand wall as the tool realigned the grains. He slipped out, and her ears followed his progress to the surface.
"What will we find out there?" she wondered. "Harkonnen troops and the Sardaukar? Those are dangers we can expect. But what are the dangers we don't know?"
She thought of the compaction tool and the other strange instruments in the pack. Each of these tools suddenly stood in her mind as a sign of mysterious dangers. She felt then a hot breeze from surface sand touch her cheeks, where they were exposed above the filter.
"Pass up the pack!"
It was Paul's voice, low and guarded. She moved to obey, heard the water leader John's gurgle as she shoved the pack across the floor. She peered upward, saw Paul framed against stars.
"Here,"
he said, and reached down, pulled the pack to the surface. Now she saw only the circle of stars. They were like the luminous tips of weapons aimed down at her. A shower of meteors crossed her patch of night. The meteors seemed to her like a warning, like tiger stripes, like luminous grave slats clabbering her blood. And she felt the chill of the price on their heads.
"Hurry up," Paul said. "I want to collapse the tent."
A shower of sand from the surface brushed her left hand.
"How much sand will the hand hold?" she asked herself.
"Shall I help you?" Paul asked.
"No."
She swallowed in a dry throat, slipped into the hole, felt static-packed sand rasp under her hands. Paul reached down, took her arm. She stood beside him on a smooth patch of starlit desert, stared around. Sand almost brimmed their basin, leaving only a dim lip of surrounding rock. She probed the farther darkness with her trained senses. Noise of small animals. Birds. A fall of dislodged sand and faint creature sounds within it. Paul collapsing their tent, recovering it up the hole. Starlight displaced just enough of the night to charge each shadow with menace. She looked at patches of blackness.
"Black is a blind remembering," she thought. "You listen for pack sounds, for the cries of those who hunted your ancestors in a past so ancient, only your most primitive selves remember. The ears see, the nostrils see."
Presently, Paul stood beside her, said,
"Duncan told me that if he was captured, he could hold out this long. We must leave here now."
He shouldered the pack, crossed to the shallow lip of the basin, climbed to a ledge that looked down on open desert. Jessica followed automatically, noting how she now lived in her son's orbit.
"For now is my grief heavier than the sands of the seas," she thought. This world has emptied me of all but the oldest purpose, tomorrow's life. I live now for my young duke and the daughter yet to be."
She felt the sand drag her feet as she climbed to Paul's side. He looked north across a line of rocks, studying a distant escarpment. The faraway rock profile was like an ancient battleship of the seas outlined by stars. The long swish of it lifted on an invisible wave with syllables of boomerang antennae, funnels arcing back, a pie-shaped upthrusting at the stern. An orange glare burst above the silhouette, and a line of brilliant purple cut downward toward the glare. Another line of purple, and another upthrusting orange glare. It was like an ancient naval battle, remembered shellfire, and the sight held them staring.
"Pillars of fire," Paul whispered.
A ring of red eyes lifted over the distant rock. Lines of purple laced the sky.
"Jet flares and laser guns," Jessica said.
The dust-reddened first moon of Arrakis lifted above the horizon to their left, and they saw a storm trail there, a ribbon of movement over the desert.
"It must be Harkonnen thopters hunting us," Paul said. "The way they're cutting up the desert, it's as though they were making certain they stamped out whatever's there, the way you'd stamp out a nest of insects."
"Or a nest of Atreides," Jessica said.
"We must seek cover," Paul said. "We'll head south and keep to the rocks. If they caught us in the open..."
He turned, adjusting the pack to his shoulders. "They're killing anything that moves." He took one step along the ledge and, in that instant, heard the low hiss of gliding aircraft, saw the dark shapes of ornithopters above them.
"My father once told me that respect for the truth comes close to being the basis for all morality. Something cannot emerge from nothing," he said. "This is profound thinking if you understand how unstable the truth can be."
From Conversations with Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
"I've always prided myself on seeing things the way they truly are," Thufir Hawat said. "That's the curse of being a Mentat. You can't stop analyzing your data."
The leathered old face appeared composed in the pre-dawn dimness as he spoke. His sappho-stained lips were drawn into a straight line with radial creases spreading upward. A robed man squatted silently on sand across from Hawat, apparently unmoved by the words. The two crouched beneath a rock overhang that looked down on a wide, shallow sink. Dawn was spreading over the shattered outline of cliffs across the basin, touching everything with pink. It was cold under the overhang, a dry and penetrating chill left over from the night. There had been a warm wind just before dawn, but now it was cold. Howitt could hear teeth chattering behind him among the few troopers remaining in his force. The man squatting across from Howitt was a Fremen who had come across the sink in the first light of false dawn, skittering over the sand, blending into the dunes, his movements barely discernible. The Fremen extended a finger to the sand between them, drew a figure there. It looked like a bowl with an arrow spilling out of it.
"There are many Harkonnen patrols," he said.
He lifted his finger, pointed upward across the cliffs that Hawat and his men had descended. Hawat nodded.
"Many patrols, yes."
But still he did not know what this Fremen wanted, and this rankled. Mentat training was supposed to give a man the power to see motives. This had been the worst night of Hawat's life. He had been at Simpo, a garrison village, buffer outpost for the former capital city, Carthag, when the reports of attack began arriving. At first he'd thought,
"It's a raid! The Harkonnens are testing."
But report followed report, faster and faster. Two legions landed at Carthag. 5 legions, 50 brigades, attacking the Duke's main base at Arrakeen. A legion at Arsent. 2 battle groups at Splintered Rock. Then the reports became more detailed. There were Imperial Sardaukar among the attackers, possibly 2 legions of them. And it became clear that the invaders knew precisely which weight of arms to send where. Precisely. Superb intelligence. Howitt's shocked fury had mounted until it threatened the smooth functioning of his Mentat capabilities. The size of the attack struck his mind like a physical blow. Now, hiding beneath a bit of desert rock, he nodded to himself, pulled his torn and slashed tunic around him as though warding off the cold shadows.
The size of the attack!
He had always expected their enemy to hire an occasional lighter from the guild for probing raids. That was an ordinary enough gambit in this kind of house-to-house warfare. Lighters landed and took off on Arrakis regularly to transport the spice for House Atreides. Howitt had taken precautions against random raids by false spice lighters.
For a full attack, they'd expected no more than 10 brigades. But there were more than 2,000 ships down on Arrakis at the last count. Not just lighters, but frigates, scouts, monitors, crushers, troop carriers, dump boxes. More than 100 brigades. 10 legions. The entire spice income of Arrakis for 50 years might just cover the cost of such a venture. It might.
I underestimated what the Baron was willing to spend in attacking us,
Howitt thought.
I failed my duke.
Then there was the matter of the traitor.
I will live long enough to see her strangled, he thought. I should have killed that Bene Gesserit witch when I had the chance.
There was no doubt in his mind who had betrayed them. The Lady Jessica. She fitted all the facts available.
Your man Gurney Halleck and part of his force are safe with our smuggler friends, the Fremen said.
Good. So Gurney will get off this hell planet. We're not all gone.
Howitt glanced back at the huddle of his men. He had started the night just past with 300 of his finest. Of those, an even 20 remained, and half of them were wounded. Some of them slept now, standing up, leaning against the rock, sprawled on the sand beneath the rock. Their last thopter, the one they'd been using as a ground effect machine to carry their wounded, had given out just before dawn. They had cut it up with laser guns and hidden the pieces, then worked their way down into this hiding place at the edge of the basin. Howitt had only a rough idea of their location, some 200 kilometers southeast of Arrakeen. The main traveled ways between the shield wall siege communities were somewhere south of them. The Fremen across from Howitt threw back his hood and stillsuit cap to reveal sandy hair and beard. The hair was combed straight back from a high, thin forehead. He had the unreadable total blue eyes of the spice diet. Beard and mustache were stained at one side of the mouth, his hair matted there by pressure of the looping catch tube from his nose plugs. The man removed his plugs, readjusted them. He rubbed at a scar beside his nose.
"If you cross the sink here this night," the Fremen said, "you must not use shields. There is a break in the wall."
He turned on his heels, pointed south.
"There. And it is open sand down to the Urg. Shields will attract a—"
He hesitated.
"Worm. They don't often come in here, but a shield will bring one every time." "He said worm," Howitt thought. "He was going to say something else. What? And what does he want of us?"
Howitt sighed. He could not recall ever before being this tired. It was a muscle weariness that energy pills were unable to ease.
Those damnable Sardaukar!
With a self-accusing bitterness, he faced the thought of the soldier fanatics and the Imperial treachery they represented. His own Mentat assessment of the data told him how little chance he had ever to present evidence of this treachery before the High Council of the Landsrod, where justice might be done.
"Do you wish to go to the smugglers?" the Fremen asked. "Is it possible?" "The way is long."
"Fremen don't like to say no," Idaho had told him once. Howitt said,
"You haven't yet told me whether your people can help my wounded."
"They are wounded."
"The same damned answer every time."
"We know they're wounded,"
Howitt snapped.
"That's not the—"
"Peace, friend,"
the Fremen cautioned.
"What do your wounded say? Are there those among them who can see the water need of your tribe?"
"We haven't talked about water,"
Howitt said.
I can understand your reluctance," the Fremen said. "They are your friends, your tribesmen. Do you have water?"
"Not enough."
The Fremen gestured to Howitt's tunic, the skin exposed beneath it.
"You were caught in siege without your suits. You must make a water decision, friend."
"Can we hire your help?"
The Fremen shrugged.